Yesterday I talked about purification by knowledge and vision of what is and is not the path. And I emphasized that a really important part of this stage is seeing the arising and passing of phenomena, the arising and passing of our experience of phenomena. And the seeing arising and passing is one aspect of the Buddhist emphasis on impermanence. Another aspect of its emphasis on impermanence is that things change. They don't simply arise and pass, they don't perish and end, but also things change over time. And however, things don't have to change randomly or chaotically. They change based on conditions, and we can put in place conditions that change goes in one direction or another direction. And if we had decided that it's a good idea to stay up late and put a big TV screen up here and watch Saturday Night Live every night, that would create different conditions for a retreat than it is to just sit quietly and silently into the evening and keep doing the practice. We can change the direction of conditions, and we have particular conditions here that have been created, and there's nothing, we don't want to make these conditions feel like it's too special, but they're designed to be conditions that are optimal for moving in certain direction towards a path of freedom, towards greater mindfulness and connection. So we have some choice about the conditions we put in place and what direction we go. If we live unethically, it just happens to be that those are conditions that leads in one direction of change. If we live ethically, it's another direction of change. And we have some ability to choose what direction we take. And what direction we take makes a big difference over a long time. But things change, and so the practice changes in various ways. If we set conditions in place that move in the direction of liberation. And so it changes over time. So a variety of changes go on, and I think everyone who gets involved with practice recognizes some kind of change over time. And sometimes those changes can be mapped on some classic maps of progress or changes that go on. I find it quite kind of very inspiring to me to see how well the maps that these ancient Buddhists have come up with work for so many people, even in the modern world. Retreat itself is a process of change, and it there's a series of changes that happen. And some of you who do a lot of retreats start recognizing some of the patterns of change, things that were maybe alarming or delightful, like in the first retreats, become just recognized that this is what happens on retreats. Some point in the retreat that we run into the hindrances, or some point in the retreat we tend to crash, or some point in the retreat we tend to get elated and want to tell all our friends. But after we've gone through it a few times, enough times, it becomes just, here we are at that point in the change and cycle, and we don't get too caught up and too excited by it. It's just part of the change. And after a while, we start also trusting the change, or trusting that we just do our best, we keep showing up for the practice the best we can. And as we do that, we're on a path, a journey. And whether it's a journey of a retreat, a journey of the progress of these purifications, or a journey of a lifetime, there is a change that unfolds. And we're trying to put in place the best conditions for the best possible change. There's a wonderful story about friend of mine who was a student of Suzuki Roshi, Zen master in San Francisco. And my friend asked him, if I practice Zen, will I get enlightened? It's a reasonable question, given that enlightenment is, you know, talked about in Buddhism. And Suzuki Roshi said to him, his answer was, if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good. And I love that answer. Almost as good is good enough if your practice is sincere. So if you're going to give yourself to the practice in an honest, direct way and wholehearted way and sincere way, then things unfold in a certain way, and it becomes good in and of itself, even though we have challenges and difficulties. Just that we're meeting it and have a path to walk is pretty inspiring. So in yesterday's talk, of the seven stages of purification, we're now at the last three, and starting yesterday, have the preface, knowledge and vision, purification by knowledge and vision. And I think kind of most literally the translation from Pali is knowledge and seeing. You see something, but I think maybe it could be seen as a figurative and a literal meaning of seeing. And I very much like the idea that it says vision, because in English we use the word vision to mean both a kind of seeing and a kind of, you know, what we see, literally, but also we have a vision for the future. We have a vision of a possibility. And this is a very important part of Buddhist practice, is to have a vision of what's possible. And if you remember earlier in the list, there was a purification of views, and now it's vision. So views all have this double meaning of what we see, the view, and also the opinions we have. But now we've gone to vision, and vision has two different, you know, overlaps, because both words can mean to see, but instead of pointing towards views, it points more to a sense of possibilities, and kind of something that we can aspire after, and to yes, say yes to, this is what I like. And it's a vision of a possibility, not a construction of opinions or stories or philosophical views. And so what we're seeing then is, as we practice more and more, is we get a glimmer of something, a possibility. We get a glimmer of something that's meaningful. And then it can be, we can use our powers of imagination, our powers of understanding, to see that this, oh, it's possible. It's possible to do this more fully. It's possible to integrate this into my whole life and have a vision of this possibility and move in that direction. So the knowledge of vision of what is and is not the path is to recognize that the path is not found by clinging to anything. Even so-called spiritual experiences should not be clung to. But what is the path is continuing to just have this very simple, direct mindfulness, seeing of what's in front of us, but to see it without any clinging. That's the way forward. That's the path. And there can be lots of rewards in all kinds of ways. They're simple, being able to see without the filter of views and concepts and ideas, but to see directly. And to see the relief of that, the freedom that's possible in that. Get a hint of that or a taste of it. And have a vision. Ah, this is possible. This is worth kind of pursuing. This is worth living into. This is something that's very valuable. And so then, start engaging maybe more wholeheartedly in this process. And at some point in this journey of the seven purifications, there's a kind of renewed dedication or devotion, like a big yes, this is what I'll do. Or it's not a conscious decision, but there's an absorption, this feels so right. There's a rightness in this, a kind of a homecoming in this, to really be present here, just not anywhere else, kind of be present here for this experience, just this moment. And then to realize that it's so good to quiet the chatter of the mind, the filters we have that we see the world in, quiet them down, so we're seeing more and more clearly what's here. And what we can see clearly is not a thing, but we see the process nature of experience, how things unfold over time, and seeing that they arise and pass. So the next stage of purification is knowledge and vision of the practice. Most commonly it's translated into English as knowledge and vision of the way, but the way is too often understood to mean like another path, but it means method, or I translate it as practice. It's the means, and particularly the knowledge and vision of the practice specifically means to start seeing the arising and passing of phenomena. And when we kind of no longer get caught up by the impediments of insight, these great spiritual experiences, but can really enter into the flow, into the stream of how things in the present moment are coming and going, arising and passing, then the tradition says that we're in this stage, beginning of the stage of knowledge and vision of the practice. This is what the practice is. The liberating practice. There's all kinds of practices in Buddhism, generosity and ethics and loving kindness and compassion, and lots of things you can do, but they all are kind of leading and building to having the capacity, the ability, to just be fully in the present moment in this very radical, simple way. Alert, upright, clear, seeing this aspect of the rising and passing of phenomena. And so this is the liberating practice. This is the practice that where knowledge and vision is going to come. And then there's a series of insights that can come along. And in this stage. So the stage is subdivided into other things. And rather than going through those stages with you, what I'd like to do first is go to the last one. Just go to the, good part. So more or less, the mature final step of this knowledge and vision of the practice is called equanimity towards all formations, or equanimity towards all conditions. And it's a radical or thoroughgoing sense of being equanimous no matter what your experience is. Some people might call it radical acceptance, because the mind is not going to be agitated whatsoever by whatever arises and occurs. The mind is not going to lean towards anything or pull away from anything. It's not going to get involved in analysis and thinking about things. The mind is going to stay very peaceful, quiet, balanced, and non-reactive to what's there. And it's a mind which is very settled, very peaceful, very tranquil, very clear, and it's kind of like the clarity is so strong that anything can go through it, and not, it's like, you can throw anything through the air, kind of, and the air doesn't mind, or the space doesn't mind. You don't ruffle space by spitting at it. You know, it's just the space stays the same, right? So the mind is kind of like space. And just things arise, things pass, things are there. And usually at this stage, so much has dropped away. So much mental activity we normally have in our daily life is not really happening anymore. And so there's very little, actually, that is arising and passing. But there are things that occur that we're aware of. It's very simplified, peaceful, calm, very simple. And some people will think that this is the same as to be awake, to be awakening. There's no suffering whatsoever. There's no hindrances operating. There's no greed. There's no hate. And no tendency towards it. So it's very satisfying. It's very meaningful. Because it's so... it has such a deep equanimity, it's not uncommon for people to sit for long periods of time. Sometimes in long period, I mean, sometimes people can sit for 2 or 3 hours without feeling any pain or discomfort. It feels just like, you know, you're sailing along, gliding. It's very, very peaceful in this state. And so it's a wonderful place to come to. But to get there from the beginning of the purification of knowledge and vision of the practice, the first kind of, you know, clear involvement with seeing the arising and passing, to coming to a place where just so peaceful and calm and settled and equanimous by what is, it's a journey. The practice is a journey. It's always a journey. So what is that journey like? Generally, the pattern is that at first it's very captivating, very absorbing to be involved in these arising and passing phenomena. It's absorbing in the same way as how satisfying it is to get really absorbed on your breathing, or really absorbed in reading a good book. So there's something wonderful about the absorption, just being really present for something. And so the feedback loop of just really being here, being present, you get pulled into this world, and some of the jhanic factors come into play. And the Burmese tradition says you enter into what's called the first vipassana jhana, where the object of it is seeing the rising and passing of phenomena. So it's very satisfying. So it feels very nice. But then after a while, it just, what stands out and highlight is that, well, wait a minute, everything is passing. Everything is passing. Nothing lasts. Well, where do I stand? What do I hold on to? What, you know, what's going on? And, you know, and so it can be a little bit distressing. And so after a period of feeling very comforted and very confident and very connected, it sometimes morphs into a kind of being a little disoriented, and some people get a little distressed from this because everything's passing and decaying, disappearing. But it's on the way to, it's going, it's on, this is the path, the journey to equanimity. At some point, there's a curious thing that can happen where people are, things are just kind of dissolving or disappearing so quickly that even the knowing of what's happening is disappearing. So there's a sound, there's a knowing of it, there's knowing the sound comes, it disappears, there's knowing, the recognition, the knowing that the knowing arises and passes too. Everything, there's nothing there that doesn't pass away. And at some point it becomes so clear in this that, you know, you don't want to, there's no reason anymore, no desire anymore to get caught up in clinging or grasping or holding on to any of that stuff. That holding on to it is not freedom. And that sense is so clear that there can arise a strong desire for the alternative to holding on. And the alternative is liberation. And this strong desire for liberation can arise. And I kind of grew up in my early years in Buddhism in a Buddhist tradition where you kind of weren't supposed to have a desire for liberation because it was a goal, and we were told there's no goal, just practice is the goal, and something like that. And I knew people who wanted to be liberated, and they were kind of saying, no, it's okay. You know, you don't need to. Something like that. So when this strong sense of desire for liberation arose for me, I thought, that's interesting. And so, but it was so strong that I called it a biological imperative. It's just like, I didn't particularly want to get liberated, but, in the usual sense, but it was like this imperative. This is what, yes, this. And then I learned later that this is a particular step in this stage that naturally arises by itself. So it seems like it's built into this journey, as opposed to the ego wanting to, be liberated. It's just kind of part of the system, part of the way that this natural process seems to unfold. And around that time also, funny things can happen. One of the funny things is that it's phenomenal. It's hard to believe, understand how much of our life is focused on concepts and ideas. And they're innocent and fine. So, for example, this bell here is, it's innocently, I just call it a bell. Everyone knows it's a bell, and it's a bell is a bell, and that's the way it is, right? But this is exactly the same size of a bowl, very similar size that my teacher in Burma used as a spittoon. And he'd be sitting giving Dharma talks, and then people complain sometimes about my cough a little bit. But, we would get phew! I don't think a Dharma teacher would get away with that in America. We have a certain kind of, understanding of the Dharma here in the West that doesn't seem to include spitting a lot. And so we call this a bell, but it could be a spittoon, it could be a soup bowl, it could be many different things. So when we're relating to this and being mindful of the bell, to a big degree, we're relating to the word, the concept of the word, the label bell. And we don't realize it because it's more or less accurate, kind of. But when the mind gets very concentrated and quiet, and just watching the process of rising and passing, these concepts that we overlay on top of them start falling away. And there's no bell. It's just a phenomena. So for some things, like if you're watching your breathing or a sensation that arises, you might recognize it that as pain or as pressure, and you have this label, and we're kind of seeing it or connecting to the experience through this very subliminal, sometimes very, very almost subconscious label. Sometimes it's not even conscious we're doing it. But when that labeling is not happening anymore, and things are arising and passing quickly, and we bring our attention to it, to the thing, by the time we get there, there's nothing to connect to. It's like you put your hand to touch a hologram, and it disappears. You can't touch it. It's nothing to touch there. And so it's very frustrating. And remember when this happened to me, I thought it was so bizarre. I'd been practicing mindfulness for so long, and I practiced, it was going well for me. And then I had the feeling, I don't know how to be mindful anymore. How could this be? I don't even know what mindfulness is anymore, because every time I turn my attention to be mindful of something, it disappeared, and there was nothing there, nothing to touch, nothing to connect to. And that's partly because it's changing so quickly, and partly because how much we've been relying on a label, to connect to the experience. And then it's very frustrating, and And it's sometimes it's called in the tradition rolling up the mat stage. And you should, if you remember nothing else from this talk, remember the rolling up the mat stage. So when you, if it ever happens to you, you'll recognize it. So you rolling up the mat means you you roll up your sitting mat and leave. Or it takes the form of people are sitting and meditating, and it's not working. So you get up to do walking meditation. But walking meditation doesn't work. So you come back and sit. It doesn't work. And you try all these things, and nothing works. So probably not a good strategy, but it didn't hinder me, but I don't feel particularly proud of it. But so I went through this, and my strategy was, it usually happened late in the day, in the evening, so my strategy was to go to bed. You know, it's late enough, I'm tired, might as well. So, anyway, so rolling up the mat, because it seems like you can't do the practice. The task is to recognize this as just part of the journey, and then sincerely keep practicing the best you can. Just kind of stay with it and try to be equanimous with it and just kind of keep going. And then the strong desire for liberation can arise. And that can provide tremendous fuel to really give oneself over to the practice even more. Just really, this is important. And then there's a few other things can happen along the way. Deeper understanding of the three characteristics. Deeper understanding how everything's impermanent, that there's no self in the experience, that there's some kind of unsatisfactoriness and clinging and holding on to anything. And so at some point, as the practice, the concentration gets stronger, the insight gets stronger, we come to this place of a profound equanimity, this profound peace and quiet. But it was a journey to get there. And some people, the journey is quick. Some people mostly experience the pleasant parts of the journey. Some people mostly, for whatever reason, experience mostly the unpleasant parts of that journey. You know, why is for one way or other for people, we don't always know. But it's a journey. And then at some point in this path that I'm describing in this retreat, the Vipassana path of the arising and passing comes to a place of this profound stillness and equanimity. Along the way, there's lots of visioning that can happen. A vision of freedom, a vision of a possibility of a mind which doesn't cling, doesn't resist, a vision of a possibility of mind that can be deeply peaceful, tremendous insight, tremendous understanding, knowledge of this is like, now I'm touching into the truth here in some very important way. And then this vision of a possibility of going further, or for it becoming kind of all-encompassing, or to be integrated into our being in a deep way. Because we can also see how quickly and easy it is to come back and get attached, to get caught up, to fall back on the old things we hold on to, have the mind to get back involved with the hindrances, or fall back in confusion and lose its way. And so there's a vision then of possibility of freedom, possibility of living by the truth, possibility. When it gets to this equanimity stage, there's a sense that there is freedom kind of just around the corner. Or how to say it, there's a sense that there is some release that can happen, or something that kind of like recognizing that if space is peaceful and calm, as things arise and pass, there's a sense that after they pass and before they arise, in that gap, there's space, there's peace. Or there's a sense that just kind of around the experience we're having is lots of space, lots of stillness, or lots of freedom, that it seems so pure, so clear and crystalline, that it's kind of like, there, that is unconditioned, that's freedom, that's a place as well that is so, that's kind of like that's freedom, that's liberation there. It's a sense, it's a vision of there. But any attempt to lean towards it or want it is makes the mind more active and pulls us back into the world of, you know, thoughts and ideas and holding and sort of losing the equanimity. And so it's a real art, it's a real part of art, is to learn how to just be completely equanimous or accepting of whatever is. And that's that happens to be, not coincidentally, what we're practicing all along. All along we're trying to see what is, be present for what is, and to see it without being for or against it, or wrapped up in it, or holding on to it, or resisting it, or pulling away from it, and trying to just kind of see it directly and have that direct, immediate recognition there. And one of the remarkable things about this is that it doesn't matter that much what it is you're being mindful of. What it matters is how you're mindful of it. And so part of the training all along is the how we are. And we started the retreat off the how, you know, how without being present, without any conflict, not being troubled by anything. There can be tremendous difficult things that arise in our life. The mindfulness of it doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but the mindfulness of it is learning how to be present for it without this reactivity. And then we might put a lot of sweat and hard work into trying to solve a problem, but the awareness can stay relaxed. Anyway, so it's a training, and get a glimmer of that little bit, even, you know, there's a book now called 10% Happier. That's about this practice we do. So 10% better is pretty good. So if you're, 10% less reactivity, that's pretty good. And it gives us a taste of what's possible. It gives a sense of the direction we're going. And but to really get a sense or a vision of where we're going, it turns out that this seeing the arising and passing of things, and I apologize for using this phrase so many times, it's just that this is the core insight of the Vipassana meditation practice. It's seeing this, the appearance and disappearance of things, really provides a clearer and clearer sense of how deeply non-reactive or deeply at peace or calm the mind can be in relationship to things. And it gives a clear vision that of a possibility of a place, a way of being, where there is no clinging. Because if things are constant, if things are unchanging, if things don't come, arise and pass, come into existence in a certain way and disappear in a certain way, then there's no possibility for change. There's a logic of the tradition. It's just what is. But if we see that things arise and pass, then we see in the space between them, around them, there's freedom also. What are you clinging to when it's not there? You know, it's like trying to grab air in your hand, right? What good is that? The very things that I was clinging to aren't always there. And if they're not there, then who am I? So the great question, I think, one of the great questions is, if you don't use your thoughts, if you don't answer with a thought, how do you answer the question, Who are you? Who are you? You don't use a thought to answer the answer. And chances are you get a different, little bit different sense of yourself than if you had the answer. Like, you know, I'm Gil, or I'm this, I'm that. Oh, I can't use a thought. Well, then where do I stand? How do I see myself? And when people ask this question, they're not hoping for an answer. What they're hoping for is the person who hears it lets go. Is willing to kind of just realize that we still exist when there's no concept by which we define ourselves. And so just kind of let you know, we don't need a concept, we need an idea. So in many ways, the basic practice is the same. Basic Vipassana practice is the same for someone who's a beginner and someone who's well mature in the practice. It's just to bring our mindfulness to what's happening now. And all of us, from time to time, are beginners. We go up and down the course of a day, and whatever is happening to you, whatever point you're at, is your home, is your place. It's not a mistake. The practice is always the same. To meet that with mindfulness, to see it clearly, to recognize it, and to see if you can be present with this kind of clear, equanimous attention, or 10% better equanimous. Just see it, be present for it. And if you do this, in a regular way, if you develop this and have continuity with it, there's momentum and concentration that builds. There's change that happens over time. there's a journey that that unfolds. Don't be too concerned about where you are on the path. Wherever you are is the right place for you, and has its own lessons, has its own purpose, has its own requirements to be there. But there is a vision of what's possible. There is a vision of freedom, a vision of liberation, of profound peace, a profound vision of being at home in this world. So at home that we don't need to define ourselves, prove ourselves, be anything. We can just be. Maybe like some people can feel at home, when they're at home, they can walk around in their underwear and feel like everything's good. You're at home and you just don't have to worry about anything. Once you come to a retreat center, you put on more clothes. But at home, you can just be yourself. You don't have to define yourself and be anything for anybody. You're out in the wilderness. So this kind of deep vision of really feeling at home in some deep way in your heart here. And having a vision like that is a beautiful thing to have. Having a vision of a possibility is not the same as, you know, thinking about the future or grabbing for something which doesn't exist. A vision is a space opens up, a direction. It's like the world becomes bigger with a vision. Oh yeah, that's a direction, that's a possibility. There's more possibilities than I realize. So to have a vision of liberation and to take a step of mindfulness and a step of mindfulness, step by step, and have that as the guide or support or the inspiration. And if your practice is sincere, it's plenty good enough each step along the way. And one of the things that I like to try to as a Buddhist teacher, one of the things I try to teach is the idea that each moment of mindfulness can be satisfying in itself. Each moment of mindfulness is never wasted. And so when you do this practice, to find that place where just this moment, regardless of where you're at, to really be here and be mindful for this is satisfying. It doesn't have to be anything else. Just that you're mindful of it is great. And it can be informed or inspired with a vision of how far this practice can take you. It can take you to liberation. Which is a little bit the topic for the last stage of purification, which is a topic for tomorrow's talk. So let's gather together, gather ourselves back into the meditation mode.